when an artist makes something, an artist tries to make it internally balanced and sort of and self-sufficient and makes sure that every color and every brushstroke counts. Everything is intentional. And I think we ought to see the creation that way as well. And I think if we could imagine the whole history of the universe that way, as this entirely purposeful unfolding out to the most minute little things, then it would really kind of transform the way we approach life and approach our environment and approach other people.
Katie Kresser is professor of art history at Seattle Pacific University and author of the 2019 book, Bezalel's Body, The Death of God and the Birth of Art. The book describes how art accentuates the relationship between the human and the divine. We talk about Katie's theological and devotional vision of art and how she arrived at this vision. I'm Matthew Wickman, founding director of the BYU Humanities Center. Katie Kresser, it's great to talk to you today on the podcast. I typically begin these conversations by asking our guests how they imagine their faith and the context of their life and work. And perhaps I could put that question to you this way. Did your love of art history grow out of your faith? And has your faith grown because of your love of art history?
Okay. Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah. So you kind of articulate something like a symbiotic relationship right there. You kind of suggested that, and I think that feels accurate. A little bit of background about me. I grew up in the southern Midwest, southern Indiana, in an evangelical household in a small rural town. I grew up immersed in a strong faith tradition that was also culturally insular. And I think from a very early age, art history was for me a way to imagine how my faith could have other dimensions, could have other expressions beyond the expression that I was experiencing in my small town. I was fortunate in that my dad was a high school art teacher who had gone to college and brought home art history books. And I kind of pored over those, actually going back even into elementary school and just wondering over the different ways that artists in different countries and different times had expressed their Christian faith. And I just marveled at the beauty of that and the diversity of that. And I think at times when I felt my cultural environment perhaps a little bit uninspiring or stifling, as I think maybe a lot of us do, just because the familiar sometimes becomes boring to us, I think my immersion in art history from an early age helped me to continue to feel that my faith was vibrant and had a lot to offer and had a lot of dimensions to explore. And so it has been a passion of mine for years and years. And I'm frankly surprised that I'm involved in it as a vocation and that I'm getting paid to do it, because I think it has just been my passion for as long as I can remember.
That's fantastic. You know, I love that that thing you said about art adding a fuller dimension, right, to your experience. I was a literature student, not an art student, but it was the same thing for me. Literature opened the world up for me in all kinds of ways that I was really drawn to. Mm-hmm. Now, your book, Bezalel's Body, which we'll discuss in a minute, is a theological engagement of art. I'm interested. So you're an undergrad at Indiana University, then you go off to get your PhD at Harvard. Was your work at Harvard this theological? If it was, did your professors take well to that, or did they encourage you down other tracks?
Right. Great question. It was absolutely not this theological at all. That was an interesting journey. When I went to Harvard, I initially wanted to study Byzantine art, mainly because I saw that as a flourishing of a sort of cohesive, rich artistic tradition that had come out of very early Christianity. So I kind of wanted to see, you know, what the very earliest artistic expressions of Christianity had been and how I could understand them theologically. Very shortly after that, I discovered that I really wanted to explore more sort of contemporary application, and that I had been hiding in the past a bit, and that I wanted to frankly explore theology in a more contemporary context. So I actually switched my concentration after my first year to American art and modern art kind of as a secondary concentration. But I quickly realized that I wasn't going to be able to discuss theology openly with my advisors. partly because that just wasn't their area of expertise. And they wouldn't have been competent to advise that, I don't think. That's just not what my department was about. And there was probably a little bit of discomfort among some faculty with that subject matter. So what I found myself doing was kind of approaching it in a sideways fashion. I ended up, my dissertation was I think rather immersed in what we would today call critical theory. I mean, it's critical theory. That's kind of a buzzword today, actually. I was writing this back in the early 2000s when it wasn't so mainstream. But I think what I became interested in, I wanted to approach theology, I think, through the discipline of art history by finding the gaps, I suppose, by finding the ways that an Enlightenment worldview and a sort of scientific approach to art was inadequate, and by showing how artists sort of revealed the mystery that can shine through the gaps. And so I ended up writing my dissertation on a Catholic Christian artist whose work, I believe, kind of thematized a lot of those things. I believed a lot of his work tried to sort of undermine some of the more confident ways of factually presenting things in the late 19th and early 20th century. This artwork, I mean, he was working in a milieu where art was trying to seem authoritative and exactly correct and perfect and complete. And he wanted to demonstrate in his work that really, you know, the truth is bigger than what we can express. Art is one way of showing that, is one way of kind of poking holes in the factual and the positivistic in order to let mystery shine through. And so I approached that, what he was trying to do. I believe he was doing it in a very Christian way, but I approached it in a with the language of critical theory, in a way in order to make my work fly in that department, but also because I actually think the language of critical theory is very helpful in understanding some of those things. So that's kind of what I was studying. I was kind of immersed in a critical theoretical vocabulary that made space for the transcendent because it sort of tries to squash the overconfident kind of positivistic language, yeah, of the Enlightenment and of a lot of scholarship today.
You and I have walked interesting parallel paths in some ways. If I wanted to take the time now, I could tell you about my own sort of journey through a literature department, and it's very similar to yours. And I, too, use the language of critical theory. I'm very immersed in the Enlightenment with a lot of the same interests that you have in the way you describe that. Let's turn, though, instead of this being about my journey, let's turn to your book, Bezalel's Body, The Death of God and the Birth of Art. Perhaps you could explain both the title and the subtitle of that book.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. So I struggled with the title a lot. It changed a lot of times. Bezalel's Body, the kind of main title, refers to the Ark of the Covenant, and the tabernacle that was crafted by an artist named Bezalel in the Old Testament. So Bezalel was an Israelite artist called to craft the Ark of the Covenant and the tabernacle according to God's directions, but I think with some latitude. And he created this beautiful, kind of mysterious object that's lost to history now, but it was covered with gems and precious stones, and it was very mysterious, and it had these two golden angels on the top of it, and one can only imagine how splendid it must have seemed. But so the body of the title, so Bezalel is in some ways maybe the first artist in the Judeo-Christian tradition who kind of launches this trajectory of what Christian art can look like and how it should be theologically informed. And then the body refers to the Ark of the Covenant and the tabernacle that he made, not to his body personally, although I think that could be part of the meaning too. He, as an artist, as someone with kind of sacramental meaning in himself, as someone created by God for a specific purpose, but he also created this body, the Ark of the Covenant and the tabernacle, which was something that the Israelites could engage with as an object that helped them engage sort of physically with God in a way they never had been able to before. So it's a body with which one can interact. And I believe that art can also be that sort of vicarious body with which one can interact in their quest to encounter God. And then the death of God and the birth of art is sort of an oblique and maybe sort of titillating, I don't know, way, because it kind of makes you think of Nietzsche a little bit.
It did me, yeah.
Way of linking Christianity itself and the death of God as Christ, and then implicitly there is his resurrection as well, because I'm a believer, but Christianity, which is this religion that incorporates into itself the death of God, is also a religion that gave birth to art as we know it today. I feel that art as we know it today, the way we encounter some objects and think of them as artful, actually depends on a sort of basic Christian understanding of the universe. I don't think that art as we know it today existed before the Christian paradigm existed in the world. So I'm kind of saying that Christianity invented art in a sense.
Okay. Let's turn then to the book's argument, which is a really, I think, fascinating argument, Katie. I was very drawn by it, positively provoked by it, and it to thought about this. And it's hard to have an in-depth discussion of individual pieces of fine art, you know, in a meeting like a podcast. But maybe we can talk about, though, the pieces of the book's argument, kind of the main points you make. One of them that you make early in the book, and it's kind of, it sets a frame, is that life, so much of life is about coming to terms with otherness, right? Things outside of ourselves, things that are foreign, often threatening to ourselves. And you make the point that art assists us in that reckoning. Can you elaborate on that point?
Yeah. I believe that, and maybe this is based on my personal experience, I think. I think a lot of the time when we scholars sort of make assertions about the way life works, we're just drawing on our own personal experience, whether we're willing to admit that or not. But I believe that most human beings are fundamentally self-centered. I believe that we are, most of us, either born into a state or quickly sort of evolve into a state where we become self-protective, and maybe due to trauma or disappointment or just an inability to grapple with the complexity and sort of tragedy of the world, we put walls around ourselves and we're unable to sort of encounter each other fully and truly. We're always seeing other people through lenses of sort of self-protection and fear, or maybe even sort of utilitarianism, like we look at people for how we can use them and we don't look at them in their fullness. For me, art is a tool to help us sort of break down those walls. I describe art as sort of a low stakes space where we can try to begin to encounter the other without very dangerous repercussions. Art provides a focus where we can kind of come out of ourselves and sort of fully encounter something other in vulnerability. And if we do that enough, then maybe we can start to take that into our lives with actual other people as well. And I will add that I think this necessity to be open to the other and just fully accepting of the other and just self-present and fully seeing of the other is really the shape of the interior of the Trinity, right? Like there's Father, Son, and then the Holy Spirit emerges from that relationship. And so this fully open, fully accepting, and fully seeing relationship is at the heart of reality. It's in the heart of God. And we are all ultimately called to duplicate that in our own lives. And for me, art can be this sort of vicarious place where we can start to do that and start to inch out of our little protective zones.
Did you have that sense of art when you were younger? I mean, you go back to your dad taught art, right? And he'd been through college. Did you have that sense that art gets us out of these protective zones and it connects us in a way to what's divine when you were, say, a high school student? Or is this an epiphany of a mature person looking back and saying, you know, I there's always been something that's drawn me to art, and now I can finally explain what that is?
Good question. Yeah, I do think that for me, living in a relatively culturally monolithic environment as a younger person, art was a way for me to encounter things that I couldn't see in real life, sort of, and a way for me to sort of be open to things, to experiences, to concepts, to just sort of states of reality that weren't available to me in my immediate vicinity, and to sort of, yeah, practice opening myself up in that way. I don't think I was conscious of that, though. I think, like you were saying, this idea of like formulating it this way, that art is something that beckons us into otherness and provides a focus where we can sort of practice an openness to otherness, is not something I would have been able to formulate until I was much, much older. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. You know, one of the points you make, another point I guess that's important to the book, I want to see if you can elaborate on that point. And you've touched on it already, but maybe to touch on it a bit more here. You know, art, you said earlier, it's an invention of Christian culture. And art is also a material medium, you know, a color, shape, texture. You know, mm-hmm. It strikes the senses. But you make the point that Christianity posits a dignity beyond material things, so that mm-hmm. In art, this material medium, there's still representations of things that are deeper or higher than anything mm-hmm. merely seen. Mm-hmm. Can you elaborate on that point a little bit?
Yeah, let's see. Yeah, so backing up just a little bit, I feel like before Christianity, we talk about the paradigm of the idol. Like in the Old Testament, the prophets are railing against the idols of all of the other tribes. And if you look at world culture, you do see that a lot of ancient cultures venerated idols. And the way they treated the idol was as a sort of self-contained place where the god could be held in kind of a little container, like a three-dimensional container, and it could be manipulated, and it could be, and things could be brought to it, and it could be petitioned, and it was thought to just, like, I don't know, just be a little kind of focus of energy right there where the god was present, and it was almost as if the lines, the outline of the idol was contiguous with the outline of the god. So it was a way of trying to bring the transcendent down and hold it and control it. And for me, Christianity acknowledges that material reality is connected to God and is created by God and is precious and beautiful and bears resemblance to God, but it also insists upon the transcendence of God. He transcends tribe, he transcends containers, he can't be contained, and he transcends all forms. And so for me, the artwork as we know it today is like that. It is a material thing that bears something like a divine spark in it. It seems to resemble something about the divine. It gives us joy. It beckons us to think of something high and beautiful, but we also understand that it's insufficient, that it's incomplete, that the divine isn't contained there. So Christianity's paradoxical, right? A transcendent God becomes man. And for me, the artwork kind of duplicates that paradox on a much smaller, humbler scale. Hopefully that answered your question.
Yeah, it's great. It's great. And I find it really compelling how you describe that. Really, it's in some way you're describing art as a spiritual experience. I mean, just the way you're mm-hmm. talking, it beckons us to something higher, something transcendent. Mm-hmm. It connects us to that which is outside or beyond ourselves. One of the points you make in the book is that much modern art, while it's powerfully, often ingeniously creative, nevertheless, it falls short of the historical dignity and function of art as you describe it in this transcendent way. Can you help us understand that point?
Yeah, I think so. I will say, you mentioned that art is spiritual, and I do feel the way we conceive of art since the Renaissance, at least. Anyway, I don't want to go back too far. The concept of art as we know it is a relatively new concept that took a while to develop. But anyway, I think a lot of us just think of art as something spiritual. And even people who are not spiritual people themselves, who are not religious, go to art in order to have a spiritual experience. And they go into art museums because they're looking for some kind of spiritual experience. And the art museum has almost a little bit of a temple or a church feel for them. They might not even acknowledge that explicitly, but that's kind of what they're looking for there. And I think that through much of art history, artists, whether they were believers or not, sort of implicitly knew that. And what they tried to give people who were coming to their work was a kind of spiritual experience. They were acknowledging, whether they were very explicit about the terminology or had any theological background to it, they were acknowledging that they were trying to give people a little taste of transcendence. Maybe outside of any particular belief system. I do think that in recent decades, art has taken a turn where just different theorizing, the way different artists have been proceeding, there's been more and more effort to try to squeeze out any implication of transcendence and to continue to try to boil down art to something that just pushes sensory buttons. And so I think, I'm not sure if this is what your question was getting at. If I think about artistic movements, I think this is something like kind of starting like pop art and minimalism and op art and things like that. I mean, a lot of them are just like, they're interesting, but there's a core cynicism to it, and that there's just this owning up that, nope, I can't reach the transcendent. There is no transcendence. I'm just going to try to push your sensory buttons. And those things that you thought were transcendent before, they were just artists really expertly pushing your sensory buttons. And it was all a bit of a ruse. But if you want to come in and have your sensory buttons pushed, I will push them for you and you can have a nice time. I think there's been a turn in the mid to late 20th century toward trying to squash transcendence out altogether, at least for a while, though I think it may be creeping back in, actually.
That's interesting. You know, years ago, I remember reading an essay by the art critic Clement Greenberg, and he said something, and this is old memory, Katie, and so it's kind of, it's corroding memory, okay, but I'll try to reconstruct the basic idea. He says that, you know, artists at some point in like the late 19th, early 20th century lost the capacity. I mean, there was so much. His idea was that we were kind of cut off from each other in societies. We were increasingly complex and alienated one from another. And artists lost a sense of deep connectedness with their audiences, with their viewers. And that when that happened, they retreated inside themselves, wanted to create artworks that were sufficient on their own terms. It's a version of this kind of anti-transcendent, anti-leading the artist to the viewer movement, and insisting on just the materiality of what we can see in and for itself. It reminds me what you're saying of Greenberg's observation made a few decades back.
Yeah, that could be the essay Avant-Garde and Kitsch.
Yes, that's the one. You are good. Yes, exactly right.
For me, I agree. I feel like Greenberg, so he tries to make this distinction between high art, which is esoteric and sort of difficult for the masses to understand, and kitsch or low art, which is sort of the pablum that the masses enjoy, but that is ultimately corny. And that he implicitly just doesn't like so much. But yeah, what he's kind of articulating, is this social split between what all the ordinary people like and then what is sort of challenging and really artsy. And you can kind of tell what side he comes down on. But I do think you're right. Like the conclusion you drew about artists being cut off from society kind of collapsing in on themselves. I feel like he wouldn't have put it in such a negative way for artists. I think in some ways he approved of that split. I think that's true. Like, I think what he was articulating was artists sort of spinning off and doing their own esoteric thing because popular culture had become so commercialistic and tacky because it was too capitalist and he was a Marxist. So it was good that the artist spun off and did these more challenging esoteric things that were more investigating the property of the medium and stuff like that. But so he more celebrated that, but there's also just something deeply sad about that. And I don't know that he himself fully understood how deeply sad that was, but it was sad. It was this high, low culture sort of schism that meant the two sides couldn't see and understand each other anymore. And from then on, I think the art world has been this sort of elite enclave of like big ticket commodities and people using pretentious language. I mean, honestly, that's how it looks from the outside. And it really is that way sometimes because of this fundamental misunderstanding. I like the way you put it. I don't know that he personally would have agreed with it, but it was implicit in what he wrote, I think.
That was great commentary on my riff. That was so much better than what I gave you. That was really, really good, Katie. Thank you very much. So the scholar in me, you know, found myself provoked in positive ways by your book's argument. The Christian in me, meanwhile, was moved by several of your observations that I'd characterize as spiritual observations. And I wonder if you could comment briefly on some of them, right? Here's one. This comes from page 79. You remark that God is the perfect builder, the perfect artist. Eventually he, quote, will make an edifice in which every stone is needed and none is superfluous. It's a lovely idea. You know, we have, there is such a tendency that we have to subdivide our communities, to call some things worth more than others, some people worth more than others. And your point here is that actually God, the perfect artist, has a need and can bring out the radiance of all things. I found that to be a really lovely idea.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, so I do think we are still mired, I think, in a worldview of sort of utility and waste. Even those of us, I think, who would reject that idea still tend to look at things as like, is this thing whole and like integrated and perfect and useful and productive? Or is it flawed and I should toss it out? I think we still think in those terms. We think in those terms regarding people. We think in those terms regarding the environment. We think in those terms regarding everything in a certain sense, because we're all constantly trying to think of the use value of things, like what use can we put to it and what kind of profit can we get from that? And the profit could be monetary or it could be some other kind of profit. But we're constantly thinking about how we could use things, and things that aren't useful, we discard. And I think we look at all of geological history that way. I think one way you could look at the theory of evolution is the universe deciding what it was going to keep and what it was going to throw away. And so embedded in our geological record is all this waste. so we just have this waste paradigm, like just rooted in our minds. And I would like to suggest that God has been building extremely purposefully the whole time and nothing was wasted. We just can't see it because we're pretty stupid compared to God. Sorry. Like, we just can't see the big picture. We don't understand all the different dynamics he's had simultaneously going this whole time. And so, when an artist makes something, an artist tries to make it internally balanced and sort of and self-sufficient, and makes sure that every color and every brushstroke counts. Everything is intentional. And I think we ought to see the creation that way as well. And I think if we could imagine the whole history of the universe that way, as this entirely purposeful unfolding out to the most minute little things, then it would really kind of transform the way we approach life and approach our environment and approach other people.
I love that. And I think that point you make about that waste paradigm that kind of dominates our thinking and has as a collective whole for a long time, that's really a failure of imagination at some level, right? To see the world that way, to see other people that way, to see our geological record that way, as you kind of a compounded waste upon waste, like the wasteland in which we're all born. Another observation you make in the book, this is from later in the book, page 162, you write that when we have reached the point, when we have reached the point when we have become fully resonant, we find ourselves loving of everything, empathizing with everything, and thus, in a way, participating with everything, just like Jesus the Ascended. It's a lovely thought. It's a lovely thought. Can you elaborate?
As you reiterate that to me, that sounds like so extremely challenging to me.
Absolutely.
I'm like, did I write that? Because that sounds so impossible. But I think, you know, it's something to aspire to, right? Like in the book, I talk about how art beckons us to openness, and that ideally we would all be so fully open and just accepting and welcoming of like just the being of the things around us. I want to say like ontologically welcoming of everything. That's a big word. Ontology, like being the being of things, like just the fullness of what's around us, full people opposite us and whatever it is they're bringing to us. I think that's an ideal for me. If we could just be that open and that accepting and not threatened and not defensive and not sort of traumatized, because God will heal us, hopefully, and not distrusting, but just open, so that we can engage in love with everything. And I think, it's an ideal to strive for. I think in a way, when we're open to things, we can empathize with them to such an extent that, you know, their being kind of resonates in our being, and we can understand them very deeply. And so, because ultimately, we all kind of share in a way the same being, which is a being sort of granted by God. We all are kind of part of the same fabric, part of the same tapestry. So, it's a goal for me. I don't know, as you articulated, I thought, I don't know that one should recklessly just go out and try to be absolutely open to everything, until we're ready for that. And I think God works on us slowly to heal our traumas and to build our trust and to build our empathy so that we can gradually become more and more open. I'm finding that I don't think one should just go out there and lay themselves bare to all the pain in the world and be like, bring it on, because I think it's a gradual process that God makes us able to sort of accommodate as he sort of works on us and sanctifies us and matures us.
I think that's really wise. There is a discipline to being open to things, right? To sort of turning oneself off of one's own anxieties and toward things outside of oneself, being open to what they are in themselves. I think what you said about our traumas being healed, I think that's a really important thing. And that as they are, we're able to be more open, but not indiscriminately open, right? We're open in ways that are hopefully wise and pragmatic and not just idealized. One more of these really lovely thoughts. I'd love to have you comment on this one. This is a brief one from near the back of the book, page 198. You write, love is required to see things truly. Mm-hmm. Only the sight of love is true sight.
Yeah. So I spoke earlier about integration of critical theory into my doctoral work and talked a little bit about how our Enlightenment worldview of just thinking, I don't know how well I articulated this before, but that there's a single objective meaning for everything, almost as if all these objective meanings are floating above our heads and we just have to access them in complete detachment. I don't think that's possible. I don't think that exists. I think everything is relational. And I think that when we encounter other people and encounter other things, we are always encountering them in a relational way. And there is no objectivity. God himself is not even objective. God is love. He sees things with love. You know, that's not a detached rational objectivity. That's a relational perspective. So when I go to things, when I approach another person, I need to, you know, throw out the possibility that I'm approaching them objectively. I'm not. That's impossible. How am I approaching them? Am I approaching them for what they can give me? Whether it be status or whether it be some good that I need or whether it be some kind of physical intimacy that I want some kind of allegiance, tribal allegiance that I feel like I need. Am I approaching them for what they can give me? Or am I approaching them you know, with love and respect as a person with dignity equal to mine, who's unpredictable in their sort of richness and who's been created by God with just as much complexity as I have and who, you know, deserves my attention as this precious thing outside of me. Like, so for me, like I have to have an attitude toward everyone I'm approaching. I can't not. It's impossible. So is my attitude exploitative? Or is my attitude loving? That I have to, you know, make that choice, I guess. And so, since we have to choose one of those things and there's no objectivity, I think we have to choose love. And I think because the nature of knowledge is relational, you know, it is that love perspective that is the true perspective. Like that is the one that sees truly, that is the one that sees the preciousness of the other. It's just, a way of understanding truth as relational. Yeah, hopefully that makes sense. But
it does make sense, yeah.
Yeah, I believe we can only see truth in love. And hopefully I kind of explained why that makes sense. I don't know.
Yeah, and that was very, I think that was very, very beautiful, actually, how you put that. Truth as relational. This really resonates with me. It really does. And increasingly, that also resonates with new physics, right? That things are relational, right? That there is no objectivity as such. There's a lot out there.
Absolutely. I wish I knew more about that. I wish I could read a lot about that, but
yeah,
just
no poke
time
around
and
here
I
and
don't
there.
Have
yeah,
the background
no.
knowledge, but
right.
Yeah, but that's totally cool. Yeah.
Yeah. You have art, Katie. That's a lot already. So in fact, speaking of which, let me ask you, I came across your work first, not in this book we've been talking about, this really compelling book, Bezalel's Body, but in an essay you published recently in Image Journal. And the title of that piece is An Aesthetic of Lack or Notes on Camps. And I was struck by your vision there of lowbrow art, you know, often labeled sentimental, camp, kitsch, and so on. You know, when I think about what's redemptive about that kind of art, I usually think of it in terms of its use value for everyday people who aren't art aficionados, the way that profound things can communicate through rudimentary art objects like, you know, a pop song, you know, a popular movie, genre fiction, you know, lowbrow art. But your argument really goes to another level. It perceives in this lowbrow art an admission of our incompleteness, our vulnerability, mm-hmm. and ultimately our need for God. And I was so struck by this. I'm wondering how you got from these sublime windows of high Christian art, as you describe it in your book, to windows of almost similar sublimity in camp.
Yeah, good question. It strikes me, I think a lot of the early Christian art that I began studying, like some of the early icons, you know, could be considered campy in some ways. I mean, they have glittery golden backgrounds. You know, they could be considered tacky if looked at in a certain way. But anyway, yeah. Another thing I'll say really quickly is that, yeah, I do in that essay kind of try to redeem lowbrow art a bit and try to suggest how it shouldn't simply be dismissed as tacky. That having been said, I probably do think there is some art that just is tacky. like maybe not all of it maybe not all of it should just be sort of embraced. But yeah, I think what I'm trying to get at in the essay is that a lot of what we dismiss as lowbrow is art that just wears its heart on its sleeve and is just exuberant and almost childlike. And we dismiss it for those very reasons. Like we want to be all sort of buttoned up and controlling and proud and know-it-all. Like we know-it-all and we're tasteful and we're restrained. And so anything that has this just over-the-top exuberance, we just sneer at because in a way, because it doesn't fit our self-image of being in control and just knowing everything. And so, yeah, what I want to celebrate, I guess, is art that's just unapologetically exuberant and sort of bursts outside of its own boundaries, kind of recognizing its own insufficiency, that that, you know, maybe the colors are too bright, maybe the lines are too dramatic. Maybe if it's music, it just kind of gets too loud at times, or it has too many key changes, I don't know. But we need to acknowledge that exuberance there is actually ultimately humble, and humble in a good way, and that it's trying to reach beyond itself. And just like that early Christian art that you mentioned is trying to point to something beyond itself, point to the transcendent. And maybe the reason we can't appreciate it is because we are so darn prideful and full of ourselves that we are unwilling to, you know, reach out and be exuberant and try to sort of grasp for the transcendent. We are not sufficient, and sort of certain campy art proclaims that, and we don't like it because, it doesn't fit into our prideful self-image.
Yeah, that's great. And you point out that, you know, in America, our aesthetic in this nation is an aesthetic not of that kind of exuberant insufficiency, you know, reaching mm-hmm. for the transcendent, but it's really an aesthetic of sufficiency, right? We mm-hmm. we like being in control politically, socially, economically, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Now, you don't shy from your own vulnerability in the essay. I was really struck by an experience you recount near the essay's conclusion. I'll quote that here. You write, "As I sit here, I am camp. I'm wearing a glossy pink wig, and my left breast, impossibly perky, is made of silicone. I'm incomplete, and I signal this with flamboyance that does not lie, that does not masquerade as godlike, natural self-sufficiency. I can no longer pretend I am a modern material god. When I announced my cancer to my university students, one of them brought me a rainbow wig donated by a drag queen. Another mm-hmm. gave me images of wigs throughout history, including pharaonic crescents, jaunty perukes, and powdered towers bedecked with ships. All of these things showcased my lack and did not hide it. That was just right." That's such a beautiful and striking passage, Katie. Gotta ask, has your health changed since you wrote the essay, and has your perspective also changed with it? Or are you still in that same place of recognized and acknowledged self-insufficiency vis-a-vis your health?
Yeah, thank you for asking. When I wrote the essay, I was undergoing cancer treatment. I was diagnosed on Christmas Eve of December 2019
wow.
with stage 3B breast cancer. So it wasn't metastatic, but it was right on the edge. Since then, I went through several months of treatment, lost my hair, had my breast cut off, obviously. I'm through treatment now. I haven't undergone breast reconstruction yet. I'm thinking about it. Yeah, I you know, kind of resumed life as normal insofar as one can do that during COVID. I do wrestle periodically with the idea that my cancer could go metastatic. And and what that implies, yeah, about my, you know, my personal weakness and, you know, sort of the holiness of my body in a way, because cancer can make you feel contaminated, can make you sort of feel unholy in a way, I think, like you've got, yeah, you've got this unholy contaminant in you. So I would say that, you know, I don't know, trying to answer that question, I do think that's something I still think about. I have a clean bill of health right now. I probably do still work to embrace the insufficiency and incompleteness of my body and just continue to embrace the lessons of that. Because it is sort of easy after you complete treatment to get sort of euphoric and think, I have a clean bill of health now. I'm just going to go back to the way I was. I want to go back to the way I was in certain ways. But then you kind of realize that you don't want to lose those lessons. And then for me, the fact that, you know, cancer recurrence is always a possibility kind of makes me hold on to that lesson, which I am grateful for in a kind of gritted teeth sort of way. I think that's something, you know, I still wrestle with periodically, and I am grateful for that lesson. And I think what that did make me realize is how I had taken my own sort of youth and health and wholeness for granted in the past. And that had probably made me look a bit with a bit of contempt on people who, and I hate to say this, but people who were sick or who were old or who were, you know, just so clearly, sort of troubled by the world and in physical dire straits before, and how there was a certain aspect of me before that had sort of just rejoiced pridefully in my own sort of relative youth and health. And now I think I can see how, I was talking about no waste, right, earlier, how broken people, physically extremely broken people, shouldn't be discarded. And I'm one of those people now as well. And so that's just taught me that in a very visceral way. So I think hopefully it's made me just learn how to love everyone more.
That's great. You know, we're recording this on a Friday, and just yesterday, actually, a colleague presented on some current work in progress, a project in literary history, and commented on healthy and disabled bodies and how the impression of health and wholeness is really an illusion that can break at any time through serious injury or illness or whatever may befall us. You know, and I think in a larger Christian sense, of course, you know, we all live with an illness called mortality, right? Mm-hmm. Nobody is complete or entire. And what your experience like yours brings out is just how dramatic that can be brought into our consciousness in ways that really change our perspective. Mm-hmm. Let me conclude by asking you a question or two just about your aims as a teacher and scholar. You mentioned early in your book, and I found this really beautiful, that you wish to reach not only art specialists, but you wish to reach everyone committed to personal healing and growth. Does that aim define your work generally? Is that aim congruent with desire to change your field of art history as a scholar, right? Do you feel a tension between, on the one hand, the really narrow concerns of scholarship and how we impact fields, and then on the other hand, impacting people at some a deeper human or even spiritual level?
Yeah, that's a good question. The whole sort of modern university system is built on this idea that there's this objective knowledge that we're pursuing. We're pursuing it sort of indifferently in this sort of pristine, crystalline way. It's just this objective knowledge that we're building and that can then be used in this smartly, kind of rationally utilitarian way for the betterment of society. And I think one thing we've already talked about is that, I at least think that there's actually kind of no objectivity, that everything's relational. And when I bring either a loving or an exploitative attitude to everything that I do. And so I think as a scholar, and in terms of any kind of audience I would like to appeal to, and in terms of sort of how I would like to see my work applied, is I'd like to just be frank about the fact that nothing is objective, and I'm not pursuing some kind of rational utilitarian goal. And in the end, that is kind of impossible. And what I want to do is take the experiences and the knowledge that have been given to me and sort of offer them in love to whomever can use them and whomever would like to accept them. And I feel, day after day, a greater necessity to just be frank about that. And I actually think that my cancer experience has made me a bit bolder and just owning up to the fact that I am bringing beliefs and I'm bringing an attitude and I'm bringing a disposition and I'm bringing emotions into what I'm doing. And that I believe that my perspective has to be informed by love, and I have to sort of work out what that means for me in terms of who I address and how I pitch what I do. And so, I don't know. I kind of feel like I might've gotten away from the question a little bit, but well, as a scholar, I want to be frank about the fact that I'm kind of trying to bring love to it, that my work is relational, that everyone's work is relational, and that hopefully, another thing I do believe is that we all, good people of good faith, who are really striving to be loving and striving toward good are all ultimately striving toward the same thing. We realize that at different levels of fullness and with different levels of clarity, but I would hope that anyone of any belief system who approached my work in good faith could find something resonant there that would also, sort of appeal to their sense of the good and could ultimately be helpful to them.
I'm grateful for how you articulate that. For me, it's also been a journey as a teacher and as a scholar, getting to a place where I felt like, no, my real aim is to engage people differently than I imagined doing when I was coming out of grad school. And I love how you talk about this. As you put it in the book there, that you want to bring what love to everyone committed to personal healing and growth. It's a lovely ideal, and it's a lot more meaningful than just making an impact on what someone thinks about a certain period of one specialization. Katie, it's been such a pleasure talking with you. Thank you for your time.
It's been a pleasure talking to you as well. Thank you for those great questions and insights.
Yeah,
really
enjoyable. I would love to do this again at some point. Yeah, you were really such an interesting person to talk to here. Thank you, and best of luck to you.
Oh, thank you so much. You too.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the BYU Humanities Center and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University, and is produced and edited by Brooke Brown and Abby Thatcher. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips on Albany Records. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. And if you're interested in other episodes or would like to know more about the BYU Humanities Center, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.